Good morning.
Good morning,
everyone. Welcome to Zen Center. For those new faces that I see out there, it's nice to see you all. I'd like to talk this morning about the threefold training and complete giving. And I was inspired to do this by a couple of different things, the first of which was the cover article in the Compassionate Ocean newsletter several months back that was written by Michael O'Neill. Compassionate Ocean Dharma Center is one of our kind of Zen Center siblings here in the Twin Cities. For those of you who don't know, there are four different Zen centers in the Twin Cities. And Compassionate Ocean is here in Minneapolis with us. And I practiced with their Sangha for a period of time several years back. And Michael O'Neill and Joan Snyder O'Neill are the head teachers at Compassionate Ocean. And they're lovely teachers. And he wrote a wonderfully written, very short article about how he saw the threefold training. So I owe him a debt. Actually, for a number of reasons, but I owe him a debt this morning because I'll be borrowing liberally from his article. And the second thing that inspired me was a quotation that we always post on our fundraising bulletin board when we have a fundraising drive every year. We have a bulletin board that has kind of a thermometer, you know, that shows how close you're getting to your fundraising goal, that kind of a deal. And there's a little quote on there. And I'm afraid I don't know the context. I don't recognize the teacher's name, and I don't recognize the larger arc of the story from which this quote is taken, but the quotation is the one that's on your program, at the top of your program today. And the way it was in my head, anyway, it goes something like this. The student asks the teacher, "What is the gate to Zen practice?" And the teacher responds, "Complete giving." And after thinking about these things for a while, I decided that the threefold training from classical Buddhism and this idea of complete giving are essentially the same thing. So that's what I'm going to do today, is try to kind of marry those two together. So I'll start with the threefold training. That's also on the front of your program today. The dividing lines didn't come out in the copy. I don't know why, but the threefold training in traditional Buddhism is broken down into virtue practice, mind training, and wisdom. So the eightfold path of Buddhism is said to fall into one of those three categories. Each one of those steps of the path falls under one of those three main headings. So the threefold training, again, comes right out of the Pali Canon. It's the oldest of historical Buddhist teaching, so about 2,500 years old. And in this article that I was reading by Michael O'Neill, he had an interview with Katagiri Roshi, the teacher who founded our temple here, and he asked him, what is the basic Buddhist practice? He's essentially asking the same question that the student does in the exchange there. And in Zen literature, in Buddhist literature, it's pretty common for there to be stories about a student asking a teacher the fundamental question, whatever the wording is around that, but kind of wanting to know what is the crux of the matter, what is the heart of everything, what is it that you're offering me? And Katagiri answered him, the threefold training. Threefold training is the basic Buddhist practice, and everything comes from that. So considering who said it, that for us is a very big statement about the centrality of the teaching, of the threefold training, and it's not only about its centrality, but it's about its importance. And the other thing that lends some import to that teaching is the fact that the Buddha taught this model for the 45 plus years that he taught. After his awakening, he taught this same thing in different forms, different language, using different stories, different means, for about 45 years before he died. So this is core stuff in Buddhist practice. So like lots of Buddhist teaching, this training has, you know, separate elements that we think of kind of conceptually, but those separate ideas are, they're inseparable from one another. They're interdependent with one another. So when we take something like the Eightfold Path or the Threefold Training, or Buddhism's very fond of lists, you guys. You probably know that already, right? But when you take one of those things and go really deeply into it, you see that all of them are contained within that. So don't get too hung up on the lists and the numbers. So things like Threefold and Eightfold refer to things that are different, but they also aren't. The metaphor I like is like a piece of paper that's been folded into thirds. You've got three parts, but it's one piece of paper. So that's very much the way the Threefold Training is talked about. It's an integrated whole, it's cohesive, but it gives us an opportunity to kind of conceptually look at these things from different angles, and that helps us. I think we need that kind of discursive thinking around these things. So, in traditional Theravada canonical texts, so this is classical Orthodox Buddhism, pursuing the Threefold Training leads to the abandonment and extinction of the three poisons, which are greed, hate, and delusion. In Buddhism, it's thought that all the causes of suffering comes from the three poisons. And the three poisons are our greed, our aversion or our hate, and our delusion, our confusion. That is at the root of all the things that cause us suffering, essentially. So these threefold trainings are thought of as kind of the antidote, so to speak. As many of you know, the core of Buddhist teaching is the problem of human suffering. That's really it. That's really it. We have lots of different trappings around that, but the core of it is the problem of human suffering. And what do we do about human suffering? What do we do about it? It's very practical, I think, in that way. So it follows kind of a medical model of we all have this disease called suffering. What's the symptoms of that disease? How does the disease behave? What do we take? What can we do? What's the prognosis? According to the Buddha, the outlook was very positive. There's a solution to these things. We can actually work with these things and transform them. Essentially, he said that suffering is optional. Ultimately, it's optional. We can let go of it. So the threefold training is translated, and I'm not going to use the Pali here or the Sanskrit because I'll just slaughter them, and that's not good for any of us. But they're basically three categories of ethics, ethical action, virtue, or I'm sorry, ethical is virtue. Second one is mental training. We work with the mind. The causes of suffering are up here in Buddhist thought, so we work with our mind. Ethical action refers to our action out in the world. Our speech, how do we talk to one another? Our actions, how do we treat one another? Our livelihood, how do we make money? How do we join our society without harming one another? Ethics. The mental training portion is made up of our effort, our mindfulness, and our concentration. A lot of you know this from the Eightfold Path. How we work with the mind. And then the last of the three is wisdom training. That's right view and right intention. So that's the Eightfold Path broken down into three sections. And the root word in Pali for these three trainings is adi. That's the only word that I will mispronounce today. In the book I was, or in the reading that I was doing about this, the meaning of adi was interesting, and so that's why I'm mentioning it. The root word for these trainings, this word adi, points to something that is collective, primal, pre-verbal, pre-literate, aboriginal origin. So we're talking about the roots of things, the absolute roots of things, not what we add later, the fundamental root. And again, as I mentioned in Buddhism, greed, hate, and delusion are thought of as the roots of the things that cause us and others suffering. So I'm going to talk briefly about each of them. And I'm going to do them in the following order. I'm going to do prajna, which is the first one I'll do, and that's the wisdom part. So on your little handout, those are the last two. That is right view and right intention. And prajna is a word that comes to us, again, from Sanskrit, and that one's normally translated as wisdom. But it's usually, from the people that write about this, that actually know Sanskrit and its nuances, they say, yeah, wisdom is good, but it's pointing to something even more fundamental than wisdom. It's a little bit deeper, even. A Western equivalent would be something maybe like gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, for those of you who know. So something that is not necessarily like, I know what to skillfully do in this circumstance. Something that's more innate than that, that's more, again, primal, that's more basic than that. In Zen we say, or in Mahayana Buddhism they say, wisdom beyond wisdom. Wisdom is something that everybody inherently has, something everybody inherently contains in all the cells of your body, but it's beyond your ideas of wisdom. It isn't you stopping and going, what would be a wise thing to do right here? If I really wanted to look wise, what would I do? It's none of that. It's none of that added storyline or concept stuff. This is something primal that we all have. Wisdom beyond wisdom. And in Zen practice especially, we emphasize prajna a lot because we spend a lot of time in meditation here. And prajna is oftentimes talked about in Zen literature as direct apprehension of something, personal insight into something, wisdom that comes from your own immediate, undeniable experience. So again, not ideas about something, but something that you know. Does that make sense? You know what I mean? Not something that you like memorize because you had it in your head as a list or anything, but something that you know, that your body knows, that your whole thing, like, ah, I get it. So prajna is, in this context, it's kind of how we view the world. It's a little bit of our lens, right view and right intention. In Buddhism, are thought of as having a general idea about these teachings and seeing, oh, I see how this suffering works. I see how I cause my own suffering. And that can be conceptual, I think. And also having an intention. I want to do something about that. And maybe it's to alleviate my own suffering. Maybe it's to alleviate the suffering of others. But when I say lens, it's because we're perceiving the world through this idea of, I have an idea of how this suffering is caused, and I'm now motivated to change it. Prajna is that wisdom. We have a wisdom to move into the world with that sort of intention, with that sort of insight. So. And then the second part, again, is ethics. The Sanskrit word there is shila. Now, that's usually translated as virtues or morals. And these are always about our external behavior. The way we behave in ways that can be helpful. The ways that can reduce suffering. The ways that can support life. They're usually visible and tangible. So they're a little bit less abstract than the mental training parts. This always reminds me of the precepts that we take in Buddhism. If you become a Buddhist, you take precepts. I'm not going to kill. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to, you know, harm others, that kind of a thing. So these are about behaviors. But in Zen, we also talk about cultivating the mind state, the state of being that keeps those precepts. So that it isn't something added from the outside. Boy, I really want to punch this guy, but the rule says not to, so I won't. Well, I mean, that's helpful. It's helpful not to punch the guy. But what's even more helpful is to concentrate our efforts into cultivating a state of being, a way of being in the world, where those impulses don't arise as quickly. A state of being that naturally keeps the precepts without this idea of keeping the precepts. You know, not doing the right thing because I'm doing the right thing. More of just doing it automatically without even thinking about it. Behaviors reflect our state of mind, essentially. Yeah, behavior comes from thought. It reflects our state of mind. So working with our mind, cultivating a non-harming posture of mind, then those ethical legs take care of themselves. And that leads us easily to the third part, which is samadhi. The word there is samadhi. Those are the second three there on the list. That's right effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And those are the parts that we spend the most time on here at Zen Center. Because that is about keeping the right state of mind, cultivating states of mind, working with states of mind, observing states of mind. Samadhi is usually translated as concentration, maybe, or focus. So in a specific sense, that can be like during meditation practice, having an object of focus, you know, a specific thing to which you return, like your breath. But in a broader sense, this can also be about returning your awareness throughout your day, whether you're on a meditation cushion or not, returning your awareness and your consciousness back to the moment, back to where your life is actually happening, instead of being lost all the time in the storyline and the dialogue in your head. And the ability to return to your life, reality, just as it is, takes a lot of discipline, I think. I think it takes a lot of discipline. And it's difficult. The mind is busy. And when the mind is busy and scattered, it's weak. You know, it's not focused. So we're tempted to let our energies disperse and chase after the next shiny thing. I have two cats, so it's almost impossible for me not to think about a tinfoil ball. Because I've seen them be like in a state of perfect zazen, like just watching something. Their body's entirely relaxed. Their posture is perfect. Their attention is like a laser beam, and yet they're completely calm. So I'm like, wow, that is zazen. I will never be anywhere close to that. And then at other times, just like, oh, shiny, 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 all over the place, with the attention span of a gnat. You know, they just, you know. So I'm like, yeah, I can see my mind in both of those things. The latter much more, actually. But that's one of the things we do here. That's one of the reasons we sit every day. We practice. Not only to know what the contents of mind are, to watch what comes up, to get to know what this thing is that we walk around with all the time, but essentially to flex that muscle, to exercise it, to be able to develop the ability to put our mind where we want it, when we want it there, for as long as we want it there. I mean, it's very, very simple. But these brains we carry around are like wild horses, most of us know. You know, they kind of lead you around. Wouldn't it be nice? You know, they kind of make a poor master and a good servant. It would be nice if we could control that, wouldn't it? If we could keep it where we wanted it. And that's so much of what Zazen practice is about. So these three trainings, the threefold training of virtue and mind and wisdom, they're essentially about living our lives a little more mindfully, I suppose you'd say. Nelson Mandela once said, "We must live our lives carefully." That's a really simple sentence. We must live our lives carefully. And I think, wow, that's kind of the essence of Zen practice. I know he's not a Zen guy at all, but that sums up so much of what it is we do. And ethics speak to being careful. Mind training speaks to being careful. And cultivating wisdom speaks to being careful. So the threefold training is not a list of things for you to memorize, and it's certainly not a moral correctness indicating scale or anything like that, so please don't use it that way. It's really a practice that involves all of us. So it's body, it's mind, it's spirit. And we give all of ourselves to it if we want it to transform us. And the important thing for me, I think, is that I try to rededicate myself to giving myself to these trainings, and it's not because I should. I think when I first started practicing Zen, I had an idea that, I had an idea that it was going to give me some sort of huge experience, you know, enlightenment experience. And I got over that after a while because it just wasn't happening. Thank goodness. But then for a long time I did it because it felt like the right thing to do. I felt like I'm being a good boy, essentially, if I'm doing my sitting every day and trying not to use harmful speech, and I think those are helpful. I think the teaching can come to us from the outside like that. But I think ultimately and eventually, it has to take deeper root in ourselves and come from more of an internal place. It's almost not even about me anymore. I think it ends up coming from a place that's fundamentally joyful, and we do these things because it's really feels good. Do you know what I mean? Like it's bigger than just I should. It's like, because this is a fundamentally joyful practice. It benefits me. It benefits others, and I can see it. And it becomes not abstract and not a rule to live by or anything like that, but something more instinctual. More like, I'm acting this way because this is how humans fundamentally act, and we just forget. So I think once we kind of taste that, once we really get a taste of that, we kind of can't help but practice in that way. Because, you know, the more we give ourselves to it, the more joy we get, the more joy we see others get. And I do think that we end up continuing because we realize this is our deepest longing the whole time. This is actually what brought us here, you know. That's actually our true nature. So we end up accepting it, or I ended up accepting it, as kind of the ground for my life because I could do nothing else. So that's the threefold training, ethics, and the other two. That just shows I'm not memorizing them. Isn't that good? So now back to the quote, complete giving. The student asked the teacher, what is the gate to Zen practice? And the teacher responds, complete giving. I was really struck by that. The very first time I read it out on the bulletin board, and I've been kind of mulling that over for the few years we've used it. It's not out there now. We don't have the bulletin board out there now. But after I spent some time with it, I realized, for me anyway, that was speaking to non-acquisitive mind, non-acquisitive practice. And this is something that we talk a lot about at Zen centers. Not having a gaining idea. Suzuki Roshi used to say, practice without a gaining idea. And Dogen calls this wholeheartedness. To give yourself to an activity wholeheartedly. And this is essentially about going into an activity without the idea of getting some. That it isn't a transaction. I will give you one half an hour on this cushion of sitting in this weird way if you give me some peace. And if I try this for a week and I give you this half an hour and at the end of the week I don't have some peace, I'm going elsewhere. You know, and we normally have that idea. It's really, really common for us. Even if it's unconscious, well, you really do normally relate to the world in a transactional sort of way. I'm giving something to you, but if I was really honest, there's a contingency. There's some sort of I'm getting something too. You know, you're reflecting back to me that I'm cool. Or you're reflecting back to me some, or maybe it's very, very tangible. Maybe they're just giving you positive strokes and you're giving them positive strokes. And that can be done, I think that can be done without any strings attached. I think that can be done as one person completely giving and the other person completely giving. I think when that happens, we know it. I think some part of us is nourished that we feel it. Wow, I'm just giving to this person. So I don't think this is a special experience or something that's unusual. The Benedictines call this non-ownership. They have an idea of relating to objects and things and people in their lives as being always borrowed. You own nothing if you're a Benedictine monk or nun. You own nothing. You are borrowing everything. The idea there is that you're going to treat everything really, really carefully because it's not yours. So that made sense to me. I loved hearing about that, because when I was a kid, whenever we would borrow anything from the neighbors, my mom was always like, oh God, really be careful with it. We've got to return it just in such perfect condition, and we've got to clean it, and you know. That was like really a thing for her. So I got that kind of at an early age. If you're borrowing something, it almost becomes like a sacred object or something, you know. Even if it's the neighbor's mower, you still have to treat it like it's, you know. Be very careful. And that's a very neat idea. That's a very neat idea. You're just taking care of it. There's not too much of a transaction there. So the state of mind in which, and the state of heart, I think is even better. The state in which we give all of ourselves away is complete giving. And this is an ideal. I realize that that's an ideal. So we don't want to have perfect giving as some sort of new ideal that we carry around with us and measure ourselves against it. But it's just about returning to what it is you're actually doing, with nothing extra, nothing left, just burning yourself completely in that moment, just doing something, giving yourself to it. Not with any idea of getting anything, not holding part of yourself back. That feels like complete giving. And I also want to say that this is not a way of denying self or negating self. So it isn't kind of that martyrdom sort of thing of, oh no, never mind me. You guys go on ahead and have fun. I'll just stay here and eat wet cigarette butts. It's not that type of deal at all. It's never about that. It's actually the opposite of that. I think that in that kind of sense we have of kind of martyrdom, there's a secret, there's a gain there. There's a gaining idea there. There's a secret benefit. So I'm talking about complete giving, where there's not that idea of getting anything back. And the reason I think that this works with the threefold training is because I think when we give ourselves completely to our lives in that moment, when we give ourselves, there's no room for a grasping idea. There's no room for a gaining idea. So when you give yourself in your livelihood, in your speech, in your action, on the cushion, whatever it is you're engaged in, the idea of complete self-surrender to those things, giving all of yourself to those things, it's automatically complete giving. There's nothing held back. There's no expectation attached to those things. Complete giving seems like the most effective way of dealing with the Eightfold Path or the Threefold Training. So it isn't really a state of grace or perfection or anything. It's just it's a state that I think we've all experienced. I think everybody knows what that feels like when you give yourself completely to something or to someone. So here's how I think. Here's how I think that those ideas, the threefold training and this idea of giving, are the same. I think with prajna, with the idea of wisdom training, our insight into reality, our insight into our lives, our insight into truth, is ultimately an experience of non-self. When we really have an experience of fundamental connection, we see interconnectedness. We actually experience interconnectedness. Or interbeing is another word for that. When you realize that your life is larger than just you, would be maybe another way of putting that. When you start living, even if it's for a moment, when you start living without yourself being the center, does that make sense? I've seen mothers, I always think of mothers when I do this. When you see a mother and the baby starts crying and they start to move into action, and there isn't a sense of, oh, right, I'm a mom, and this baby probably wants something, and so the right thing to do here would be, you know what I mean? There's not a mental list, none of that stuff. It's just, it's an immediate action. That feels like she's so aware that this is her flesh, that this being is her, that there's, maybe just for a fraction of a second, complete interconnectedness, complete interbeing. So that's a direct insight into this is me. Taking care of this being that needs me, it is taking care of myself. It isn't an abstract idea. This is actually me. I can't claim to have experienced that. I'm obviously not a mother, but I mention that because I don't think these experiences are foreign to any of us. And we have Buddhist terms we use to describe these things of interbeing and non-self and interdependence, and those are good. Those words really work. But I'm trying to kind of say, like, this is universal human stuff. It isn't something that only Buddhists have, or something that only you get to experience if you sat for exactly 10 years and you've had thousands of hours of da-da-da-da-da-da. It isn't mystical, magical stuff. It's something we've all had a taste of, I think. So there's no sense of taking with prajna, with experience of, you know, operating from knowing how the world works, your view, understanding very deeply your intention is to help. There's a sense of flow there. It's just your life coming and going. There isn't a sense of grabbing. There isn't a sense of getting anything. When we grab it, we try to hang on to something that we want for ourselves, and we stop the flow of our experience. And we dam it up. We basically dam it up. So I think that whole concept of wisdom and our experience, our direct experience of wisdom, deep wisdom, not only comes from giving, but leads to giving. That's a natural response to an experience. A deep experience of interconnectedness, a deep experience of wisdom, is automatically to give yourself wholeheartedly. I think that is complete giving. And with the ethics part, with Sheila, the conduct, ethics, and how we behave in the world, when we find ourselves in a state of selfless giving, when we're giving ourselves, we automatically don't behave selfishly or hurtfully. Simply because the thought really wouldn't occur to us. Those are taking ideas. Speaking poorly to you, abusing you, hurting you, doing something for a living that might harm you. Those are selfish ideas. I mean, of course, they're selfish ideas. If I'm coming from a place of giving, those just wouldn't actually occur to me. Yeah, they wouldn't actually even occur to me. And I think helpful behaviors rise naturally when we're in a place of giving. Those behaviors just flow. We don't have to think about what the right thing to do is. They just happen. And with the third one, with mind training or samadhi, as we say in Zen a lot, we use that word a lot. Effort and mindfulness and concentration. We know that in Zazen, when we do our sitting here, the way we use concentration is to return back to our immediate experience. And inherent in that is letting go of that sense of self. If you're off on your narrative, worried about what you're going to do the rest of the day, when you catch yourself and go, oh, right, you know, my mind is wandering, and you come back to breath, there's just a little tiny window there. You let go of self. You practice letting go of that, your agenda. And when your mind wanders into the past and you're worried about whatever, you catch yourself and you come back. And for just an instant, it's just you and the breath. And after a while, it's just the breath. You're letting go. You're essentially practicing giving. You're essentially practicing selflessness. You're not there in a way to get in the way all the time. You know, does that make sense? That really seems, Zazen seems like the ground of all of this training, to really, really practice letting go over and over and over of this, of the construct we add that always wants something, always trying to get something. It always has its own agenda. It's always trying to work an angle. And we're so convinced it's real all the time that it just takes a lot of practice to kind of let that go a little bit and sort of see through it. So I think that I think of that as giving. I didn't before I was writing this talk. I didn't. But it's funny. I mean, I really see it. I really can see how, you know, they talk in the abstract about how, like, when you're sitting your meditation, when you're doing your Zazen, it's a gift to the world. I'm like, yeah, I guess. That's a neat idea. But it doesn't feel real to me. I'm like, no, it's not. It's me at home alone, unwitnessed, in silence for 40 minutes. Nobody even knows I did it. And I get up and my mind starts going again and I'm off. And it's just, I don't know that that made a difference. I don't know that it mattered. No one knew I did it. It's not a, you know what I mean? You feel insulated from everything and you don't see it. But the more I do it, the more I'm like, absolutely, that is giving. And absolutely it matters. The effects that ripple out and touch everything. And that's a helpful idea for me. When things get really, you know, kind of more challenging, they get tougher, I try to remind myself, if you don't have enough kind of today to sit for Martin, which I often don't, then sit for everybody else. Sit for everybody else, because it matters. It will matter. It will ripple out and affect people. So that's giving. Just giving. Just giving. there's a hopefulness to that, I think, when I think about it affecting everybody. And these Buddhist teachings, you know, these Eightfold Path, these Threefold Training, the Four Noble Truths, all this stuff, it's all about just the possibility of becoming free. I mean, this promises us, the teaching promises, you can be free. You can be free. Just do this stuff. You can let go of that thing that causes you so much suffering. And you can allow that, you can allow the truth of that to move into your life and to illuminate all your moments. When I try to remind myself of that, I tend to get very intellectual sometimes about the study and the teachings and reading all these various things as part of my training and all that. And I try to remind myself sometimes, this is all about freedom. It's about the possibility and the promise that I can be free from that which causes me suffering. That will allow me to be available to my life. Allow me to help other people who are suffering. It's so simple. It's just easy to miss, you know. I always try to add things to it, you know, to make it more interesting or have a little more meat on the bone there or whatever. And it's really so fundamental. It's so simple. Training my mind, behaving ethically, learning a worldview and a lens through which to view my experience such that I can be of service and of help. I mean, it's so simple that I think we almost miss it. So those are the ideas that I had. But so here's the takeaway for you guys. Here's the takeaway. The first step in working with any of this, and especially for those of you who are new, is just mindfulness practice. Something very, very simple. It's returning your awareness, returning your consciousness to your experience over and over. Watching your mind, observing your mind, your thoughts, your emotions, your impulses when they come up. You see them, you recognize them for what they are. There's an openness, you accept them that they're there. You let them go. Things are just coming and going. This is just your experience, coming and going. And it takes a lot of courage to return to that. Just return to your life, what's actually happening right now. Come back to it. If it's boring, come back to it. If it's wonderful, come back to it. If it hurts and it's constricted and angry, come back to it. You know, when you're present to it, it softens. It'll start to open. The freedom that you want is right there. It's right there in that actual thing that you're running from. It's right there. And when we observe these things, we see how it's always changing. It's always changing. The feelings coming and going. Coming and going. The thoughts coming and going. We just don't identify ourselves quite so powerfully with that anymore. My thought becomes less solid. I can't really grab onto that anymore. My feeling, well, but that's changing all the time too. You know what I mean? We become less calcified, sort of. We become softer. You know, more open, more available. And we start to realize that those things, those thoughts that are coming and those feelings that are coming, that's not who we are. That's not who we are. That's not who we are. So that's the challenge, I think, is being willing to be present, really deeply present with what's happening. And it could be, you know, something that's very easy to hold your focus. I was here yesterday was anybody here yesterday for Zazen? It was torrential rain for like 20 minutes, and then there was nothing for like 10, and then it was rain, and then the sun came out, and then it went back again. So for 90 minutes, it was a nonstop. I was like, well, this is like being in a movie. It's the easiest Zazen ever. We were entertained the whole time because the windows were open. You know, all this was going on. There was car horns. I was like, wow. It was a piece of cake, so very easy to be present to that because there's a lot going on, you know. And I saw a movie last night. And you know that feeling when you see a really good movie and then the movie's over and you get up and you're like, oh, and you realize you haven't actually moved, like your body has been completely motionless for, you know, 2 hours and it's creaky and you're like, wow, I was only the movie, you know, for 2 hours. So those are easier to be present with. But our challenge is to always bring ourselves back. And so maybe what it is that you're challenged to be present to right now is just the breath. You know? Have you noticed that it's cool on the way in? And that it's warm on the way out. Isn't that interesting? And you can feel it in your stomach, and you can feel it in your chest, and you can feel it at your nose. That's happening right now. In the field of your experience, that's happening. That's something you can use. The feeling of cloth against your skin. And all the things you're seeing that you will never see again. All the things you're hearing right now, you will never hear again. So your life is always, it's just shifting, shifting. It always is this kaleidoscope, this panorama that is offering itself that we can bring ourselves back to. And returning to those things, that's the practice. That is the practice. And when we recognize that we've got distracted by our labels and our stories about them, our judgments of them, attaching value to them, all those different things that we do, we recognize that. Oh, I'm in a story. I've done something. We can let go of those things. And just return back to the experience. Unmediated, pre-verbal, precognitive, just something everybody has. And it's very, very simple. And this is what we do, though. This is what we do here. This is how we use our training center. It's how we use our lives. Zazen practices, they say, does not end when you stand up from your black cushion or when you leave Zen Center. Because your life is always going on. It's always there for you. And it's very rewarding. It's very challenging, but it's very rewarding. So I'm encouraging you. I'm encouraging you. Try something. Try mindfulness practice. Try sitting with us. 5 minutes. 5 minutes. Do 5 minutes. You know, make yourself do that. See how it works. See how your experience might change if you do that every day for a week. You know, try it. Try it for yourself. Katagiri Roshi said, and I quoted this in my last talk, but I might quote this in every talk I ever give. Katagiri Roshi said that meditation and zazen is giving yourself to yourself. I can't tell you how much I love that. It's just really helped me. Giving yourself to yourself. So when we recognize that we're lost in our planning and our judging, and we're lost in our brains, choosing to come back to our life exactly as it is, that moment is complete giving. That moment is wise. That moment is training your mind. That moment is ethical, because you're coming back to what really is. And I think when we return back to what actually is, really, with no additions, we see interconnectedness. We see that other people aren't us, or are us, I'm sorry. But we see that our lives include everybody. We behave kindly. I think the whole teaching is just right there. Giving yourself to yourself. Being available to them. And it's a wonderful gift. You are a wonderful gift. So when you find it in yourself to give yourself to us, to me, to yourself, to everyone, we feel it. We notice it. It's real. You're a gift. And that's it for me. That's it for me today. I think I've said all I want to do. So are there any comments or questions or poems or songs? I was sort of nervous that somebody was going to ask me that. I saw Kung Fu Panda 2 for the second time. You can take from that whatever you wish. I saw it as part of my Zen training. I tried to get a priest discount on the tickets, but they weren't enough. No. Anybody else? Comments, questions, movie related? Thank you all very much.